Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is life like for the laborers who keep one of the world's busiest cities working, but whose humble circumstances make them almost invisible to those of greater means? Journalist Aman Sethi first met Mohammed Ashraf in 2005 while working on a magazine story about urban transformation in Delhi in advance of the Commonwealth Games. Ashraf was just a small part of that finished piece, but Sethi discovered his fascinating insights on the city where he lived and the human condition in general made him too good a subject not to keep in touch with. 7 years later, Ashraf's life story forms the heart of Sethi's new book, A Free Man, a true story of life and death in Delhi. Aman Sethi is a correspondent for The Hindu, which is one of the largest English language newspapers in India. Aman, welcome to Think.
Hello.
Tell us about your first encounter with Mohammed Ashraf and what it was about him that made him so fascinating to talk to.
Well, the first time I met Ashraf, I was, as I mentioned in the book, I was walking through this crowded marketplace in Delhi, and it was early morning, and I had been told that you know, construction workers gathered early in the morning in search of work. And I was sitting around, and I was trying to talk to various people, and, you know, it was early in the morning, so I was receiving most of the taciturn replies that most people give to nosy journalists at, you know, 6 in the morning. And when I chanced upon this one person who was extremely eloquent and vocal and chatty and absolutely switched on. And so I think that was Ashraf. So we started talking and sort of never, and kept up the conversation over several years.
And initially you worried that by interviewing Ashraf and his friends over and over, you were keeping them from work, and they essentially told you, don't worry about it. Working every day is for seasonal laborers and not for us.
Well, yeah, I mean, actually what they said was far less polite. They said that, you know, I mean, if we're willing to waste our time talking to you, then we're clearly not looking for work. So yeah, they said that the sense I got, and this was something that I didn't know of before I started researching on this book, was that there's a very big difference between, I guess a good analogy would be between freelance writers and those who work for a newspaper like myself. And so as a result of which, they were far more on the sort of freelance spectrum of work, where they worked for as long as they had money, and then when the money ran out, they started work again.
So during the time that you were following Ashraf, Delhi was trying to sort of clean itself up in advance of the Commonwealth Games that would take place, I think it was in 2010. Talk about what that meant for people who lived and worked on the lowest rungs of the socioeconomic ladder in Delhi.
Right. So I think at that point there was I think the world economic crisis has now changed this narrative. But in the run-up to the Commonwealth Games, particularly from the 2000s onwards, this was around the time that Delhi had won the bid, and the Indian economy had sort of really started growing. So we had seen, you know, several years of growth between sort of, you know, 7.5% and 10%, which was unprecedented. And there was a significant amount of wealth being created, and so there was this sort of euphoria that at least India's middle classes and the English press, which predominantly writes for the middle classes, was feeling about how India was, you know, taking its rightful place in the world. And of course, every country is always taking its rightful place. You're never. And at that point, there was this sudden move to start sanitizing the city and moving the working class out of the areas where they had worked for, you know, several generations. And there was a sense of bewilderment because the city, in one sense, is a place of opportunity. So you had people who had left, you know, families, children, wives, back home in the village and come to the city in search of work, only to be told that they were not wanted in the city. And I suppose it was just a very, very strange and disconcerting feeling to be told that you were not wanted in a city of your own country.
And for the people who happened to get by asking for handouts, they were like constantly harassed by the government during this time.
Yes, and actually, India doesn't really have a sort of system of sort of handouts, or the social security network work is extremely fragile. So there weren't actually those many people who, you know, who are asking for handouts.
Well, but were they not, were beggars not sort of harassed and bothered often?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. Beggars have always sort of been harassed because it turns out there was, there's a law that sort of makes begging a criminal offense. And it wasn't really implemented before the Commonwealth Games, but I think the Delhi government was determined to showcase Delhi as a sort of glittering metropolis that didn't have, you know, beggars or working class people or anyone that would give a kind of contradictory or contrary impression of Delhi. So they were actually given targets and told that they had to sort of get beggars off the streets and either into workhouses or just move them beyond city limits.
And factories were moved out of city limits as well, is that right?
Yes, factories were moved out earlier. They were moved out in the 2000s, like in the early 2000s, on the basis of pollution concerns. And now, in itself, these are legitimate concerns, this idea of, you know, residential and commercial and factory spaces. But these things have to be thought through, because urbanism is a complicated, the way that it's playing out in large parts of the developing world and particularly in India, that a large part of employment is actually generated by small factories, or rather they're not really factories as much as they're workshops, which are, you know, run by families and employ maybe, you know, 5 or 10 or 15 or, you know, to the maximum 20 workers per workshop. But because of the fact that there isn't a kind of, or there wasn't till recently, a very clear industrial policy and clearly demarcated industrial areas, over a period of time, these areas sort of acquired these sort of synergistic economies of scale. So, you know, you'd have one guy setting up a factory that, say, made plastics. And so next door, you would have someone that made a factory that used his neighbor's plastics in a finished product. So over a period of time, there were these, you know, urban kind of industrial settlements that sprang up around Delhi. And as the city grew, it grew around so that it encapsulated these settlements. So in 2001, all of this was moved out, but again, it was done in this kind of haphazard manner without any concern for the laborers or employment.
So for a person like you, were you not a journalist? I mean, how much contact do middle-class residents of Delhi have with people who are laboring for a living like Ashraf and Lalu and his friends?
Right. Now, well, on the one hand, of course, construction, working class professions, is broadly almost in the services category. Excuse me a second.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is these are people who are coming into your house and building your house, and these are people who are painting your rooms, and excuse me, these are people who are fixing your plumbing. So there is contact. Now, whether you use that moment of contact to actually inquire about a life other than yours is, I suppose, the difficult question.
So when you started asking around, it's clear that it was very different with Ashraf, that he was sort of willing to speak with you. But I wonder what you did to establish yourself and your credibility, not specifically in what you did for a living, but the idea that you could be trusted with their story.
Well, I think early on, of course, it's a very different way of life from anything I had seen before. So these were people who lived and slept and ate and dreamed and worked out in the open on the streets. So it was very different from, say, knocking on a door and walking into someone's home.
Mm-hmm.
It was as if there was this sort of, you know, literally an open society that plays out on the pavements. So as a result of which, it was in some ways easier to access the space because also the population is extremely transient. So Ashraf and some of the people I met had spent some time in one place, but it wasn't surprising to find someone who would come and stay for maybe 3 weeks or 2 weeks or 2 months and then move on and never be seen again or return after several years. So the sort of place itself had a vibe that encouraged easy acquaintances. So early on, we just sort of began by having, you know, kind of basic interviews that were just kind of biography driven. Where are you from? What brought you here? When do you hope to go back? What is work like? And over a period of time, as I kept coming back, one, I think the fact that I kept coming back over the years sort of suggested to them that I actually had a sort of investment in the place myself. And I had an investment in the story. And over a period of time, for instance, as people felt sick, you know, I helped out when I could. I helped, you know, take people to the hospital. So I think all these kind of gestures suggested that over a period of time that we weren't operating with a classic journalistic source model, but there was in some ways a far more complicated relationship that was developing between me and you know, Ashraf and his friends.
Talk about, he has this phrase, medium-type friends. Explain what that means and what that meant to him specifically.
Right, so at some point, Ashraf and I were sitting and, you know, again, talking about friendship and talking about the past, and he was sort of bemoaning the fact that he didn't have any of his close friends anymore. And I said, you know, what is a close friend? You have friends around you who you wake up with and sleep with and spend practically every living or waking minute of the day with. So if these aren't close friends, then who are close friends? And Ashraf sort of came, I mean, medium type, I guess, was this phrase that he came up with, which translated almost in terms of a contractual friendship, which suggested that both parties would execute the terms of the friendship honorably and respectfully, so they wouldn't be out to hurt each other. But at the same time, there would be an understanding that this is contractual but not transactional, if I may make that distinction. Mm-hmm. So the idea being that I may not be here tomorrow, or you may not be here tomorrow, and we may never see each other ever again. So how would that, how do we then still move forward as friends? And the idea was that we move forward as friends because we trust each other and respect each other, but we can't guarantee our presence to each other.
I think the book really communicates something that is not often considered when we think about the plight of working people anywhere in the world. We think about how their work is challenging, how they're not paid enough, how it might be dangerous. But for transient workers, we don't necessarily think about how lonely it can be.
Yes, I think it's not even just about how lonely it can be. I think it has to do with the fact that when, at least the Indian press, writes about, because, I mean, that's the press I know the best, mm-hmm. which is why I speak of it, speaks about the working class, they are seen purely as people, as workers. They're not really seen as people. So all the writing, a lot of it, which is very, you know, well-intentioned, quite correctly focuses on things like, you know, wages, occupational safety, but doesn't really take into account the fact that these are people. And, for instance, if you read a profile about wealthy, successful people, then, you know, we learn everything from their grades in high school to their favorite, you know, food, to the sports they used to play, to these kinds of pivotal decisions and moments in their life that they considered. But whereas when it comes to writing about the working class, it's just about, like, you know, how much do you earn, how many hours do you work? It's as if we can only see them through that one prism. I think maybe some of it has to do with the fact that the distance between India's middle class and working class is now so vast that to actually look at the working class as people would pose really difficult questions about how they are treated and about working conditions.
Aman Sethi is my guest. He's a correspondent for The Hindu and author of the new book, A Free Man, A True Story of Life and Death in Delhi. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Aman Sethi. He is a correspondent for The Hindu, one of the largest English language newspapers in India. He's also author of the new book we're discussing today. It's called A Free Man, A True Story of Life and Death in Delhi. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Aman, one thing that I think makes Ashraf so interesting is that because you reveal to us the sort of backstory of his life over time, we can imagine that his life might have turned out very differently than it has. Can you tell us a little bit about his childhood and how he was able to get such a really astonishing level of education given the resources that his mom seemed to have?
Well, Ashraf came from a small village in Bihar, and when he was quite young, his mother found work in the house of a veterinary doctor, or rather a veterinary professor in Patna, which is the capital of the state of Bihar. When that happened, as Ashraf tells it, Dr. Hussain, who was the person in whose house his mother worked, decided to take him under his wing and, you know, put him through school. And Ashraf is then in studies up to first year in biology at this college, until, of course, you know, this kind of completely unforeseen circumstance occurs, and he's forced to drop out of school. One of the reasons behind kind of stringing out the biography through the book was, in some ways, to give the sense of you know, varying possibilities, and this sense of the fragility of the support network in a country like India, where, you know, one wrong turn or one bad idea, or you say the wrong thing at the wrong time to the wrong person, and, you know, the outcomes of your life could be significantly altered.
And he had big dreams, but they always, in some ways, they didn't quite seem to pan out. I wonder how much, were there times when you were just frustrated by the choices he made about how to go about his life and how to act, because you felt like he could have had better?
So, well, there were several things that I was thinking about in the course of my interviews. One, of course, was that I was this you know, young 23, 24-year-old who had just started working as a journalist, and here I was interviewing someone who was in his 40s who had clearly survived for all these years on his own, by his own wits. So if there was anyone who would be judging the other, I felt that, you know, age and experience felt that he actually could be the one sort of, you know, looking at me and judging me rather than the other way around. And the other thing I was certain about was that I didn't really want to judge as much as I wanted to understand. So the thing is that when you live on the streets, a lot of things that seem like really bad ideas or really bad calls of judgment seem to make complete sense in the circumstances. So, for instance, I once asked, why don't you save more money? Why don't you save your money more aggressively rather than spending so much of it? And he said, well, the thing is that, A, we don't make very much money. So the amount that you would save, would take very, very long for that small amount that you're saving to actually, you know, acquire any kind of critical momentum. The second question, of course, is where do you save? Because if you live on the street, you don't have an address. And if you don't have an address, you can't get a bank account. So most people actually slept at night with all their money on them, which sometimes meant that you could be robbed in the course of the night. So there really wasn't a structure in place that made it easy to save money, for instance. Similarly, living on the street in some ways is far more expensive than living in a house. So again, you end up spending on every single thing. You end up spending to go to the toilet, you pay for water, you pay for food. You can't cook because you don't have a house to cook in, so you're constantly eating out, which is more expensive than buying your own food. So I realized that I really, every time I thought that, you know, I had a moment where I said, ah, see, you should have done it this way, there were always seven reasons why my suggestion was either implausible or improbable or just outright wrong.
There was a great moment where you asked Ashraf and his companions how much money they made. And first they turned it around and said, well, how much money do you make? And then when you told them, because you were in your first job, they sort of took pity on you and said, well, we'll buy the drinks tonight.
Yeah. And in fact, when I studied in the U.S. for a brief period, and when I came back, I met Ashraf again. And I don't think this is in the book, but Ashraf was like, so, I mean, are you earning better now? And I'm like, well, yeah, a little more. And he's like, how much are you making now? So I tell him. And again, he's like, oh, my God, you know, I mean, you've studied so much. There are people who have not gone abroad and are making far more money than you are. So yes, it was a bit kind of embarrassing, but yeah.
And when you addressed each other, you would use, am I pronouncing this correctly, you would say, like, Ashraf Bhai, which basically means, like, brother?
Yeah, Bhai means brother. So it's used, it's basically as a sign of, it can either be a sign of respect, but I think depending on your relationship with someone, it could also just literally be a way of expressing solidarity.
Hmm. Did you feel that solidarity with him? Did you feel like the way he looked at you as a friend or a medium friend was reciprocated by you?
Definitely. I think that over a period of time, I realized that essentially, and I think that's what a free man really kind of taught me, that every life sort of, in living it, you acquire a sort of philosophical understanding of the world. And if you're receptive to you know, someone like Ashraf's philosophical understanding of the world, because he's seen far more of the world in far sharper relief than I have, it really sort of absolutely alters the way you look at every single circumstance you're confronted with. And for instance, after I finished working on a free man, I reported on an insurgency in India for 2 years. And again, there were often these questions of, you know, why are you living in this space? Why, if you know that there's a battle going on next door, have you not moved? Why would you choose to, you know, side with A or B? And I figured that, you know, if Ashraf living on the street in Delhi, in an urban city, in a time of peace, is dealing with so many different kind of matrices at so many different points of time, then in these particular situations, it, you know, just trying to understand the sheer spectrum of difficulties and choices that people are engaging with are far beyond me. So it made me a far more humble, I think, person and journalist. And so over a period of time, I began to see him as in some ways a mentor, I guess.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Paul in Garland. Hi, Paul.
Yes. There's a word, serendipity, and it comes from a book called The Journey to Sandropos, which was a city. And the book was written in Sanskrit, and it was about a family that had a bunch of serendipitous events on their journey to Sandropos. Does your author's experience with his writing and his protagonist, could he compare those two?
Aman, were you able to hear the question?
I couldn't make out the sort of critical words that he mentioned.
He was talking about the word serendipity from a book called The Road to Sandropos. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly.
Okay.
That had been written in Sanskrit. I guess if you're not familiar with the work, maybe we can move on.
Well, I'm not entirely familiar with that word, no.
Okay. Then we will move on to the next question. Talk about this. One thing that you discovered in great detail was the scourge of tuberculosis on the poor in Delhi. Tell us a little bit about how this became clear to you through a young man, essentially, who you were asked to take to the hospital when he was close to death.
Right. So like so much about Delhi and India, I had absolutely, I mean, I knew that, yes, tuberculosis is somewhere out there. I'd sort of encountered it when reading about, you know, consumptives in Russian literature. Everyone is a consumptive in Russian literature. And then one day I get this call in the middle of the night saying that, you know, there's this boy called Satish and he's extremely sick. And then I learned that one, India has, I think, probably the largest number of TB patients in the world. Although, I mean, I would like put a little caveat on that, saying that I think I would need to check my figures again. But tuberculosis essentially is always in the air, it seems, in places like India, and it targets people with weak immunities. So if you're undernourished or you work in extremely hard circumstances, you don't get enough rest, you don't eat well enough, you perhaps smoke a fair amount, then you're likely to be struck by it. And when you're struck by it, the problem with tuberculosis is that it's curable, but it's an extremely long treatment. And the drugs are very powerful, so they take a real toll on your body, which makes it very hard for you to work. So it sets up this kind of difficult dynamic where you're like, okay, so if you have tuberculosis, why don't you just take your medicines? Because if you take your medicines, you can't work. And then if you can't work, then you can't eat. And if you can't eat, you're probably going to fall, you know, even sicker much faster. And so it sort of becomes this very difficult kind of matrix that you get stuck into. And the Indian government is sort of, you know, there have been things that have been adopted. The doctors I spoke to are kind of heroic. They're working in these extremely sort of, you know, overburdened hospitals and working very hard. But the problem is that because a lot of people didn't finish their courses, there came this new virulent form of tuberculosis called multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis.
So no matter what you throw at it, you can't really cure it easily.
Yeah, and, you know, I was reading a report that said earlier this year they discovered this case of what they're tentatively calling TDR, which is totally drug-resistant tuberculosis, for people who, you know, for a strain of tuberculosis that isn't responding to even second or third line treatment.
Hmm. What was really fascinating was you talk about the overburdened hospitals and the doctors who have seen a lot of suffering but have become almost inured to the suffering in some ways. But then there is mercy at this hospital. Tell us about Bhagwan Das and his extraordinary service to patients in that hospital, despite the fact that he did not have to be there ever.
So Bhagwan Das is probably one of the most amazing people I met in the course of this book and possibly have met thus far. I was at this TB hospital one day, and I was sitting with a patient and, of course, trying to sit at the right distance away and making sure he doesn't sneeze in my direction. And suddenly and everyone in a tuberculosis hospital, at least all the visitors, are always, I mean, all of us, I think, can see fear in each other's eyes because we're just hoping that this will not be the trip that will result in us getting tuberculosis, because we can see what it does to the people who are struck down by it. And suddenly this man sort of, you know, slaloms through this ward, moving from, you know, bed to bed, kind of cheering people up, and turns out that he's a barber and, you know, shaves patients for a nominal fee. And in some cases, if they don't have any money, then he shaves them for free. And so I thought that the hospital, you know, despite having a shortage of doctors, had, you know, somehow managed to hire a barber, and I was kind of impressed. But then I spoke to him, and he was like, "No, I'm not a member of the staff. I just come, you know, on my own." And so then one day I sat him down, and we had this long interview where I tried to understand why anyone would willingly put himself in this position. And he told me about how he had been in a life-threatening accident. And practically thought that his life was over. And then he thinks he met, because he was under severe kind of painkillers at the time, this man who sort of talked about the kind of mysteries of service and duty, and so decided to do this as a way of duty. And I was sort of amazed, because even in the sort of most bleak corners of the city, you would find someone who's not, you know, a wealthy philanthropist, or he's just, you know, maybe a rung and a half above the people he was serving, and he was doing it entirely out of choice.
And what he recognized about these patients was that their greatest suffering, and these are people who are just racked with coughs and fever and they feel terrible, but he said their greatest suffering was not the illness itself, but the abandonment of having this disease.
Yes, yes. Because as I told you, the effects of the disease are devastating. And if you're a poor family, and you've already had someone struck down by it, it's unlikely that your family would actually be able to keep it together if someone else had it as well, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like these people are being abandoned by sort of heartless family members. It's just that, you know, you're a family of five, and, you know, one person's got it. So everyone else is kind of, you know, working the slack and making sure that, you know, you can get as, you know, they can make you as comfortable as possible. But they obviously, because they're working in the same kind of immunity-compromised livelihoods that they're living, they've got to make sure that no one else gets that disease as well. So as a result of which, a lot of TB patients sort of just end up being alone and by themselves, and gradually sort of wasting away in solitude, and that's something that really affected Bhagwan Das, and he decided to do something about it.
What sort of role does alcohol, does marijuana play in the lives of laborers who are living on the streets and looking just for a little comfort now and then?
Right. So I guess my way of looking at this would be that, I mean, the short answer to the question is, of course, a significant role.
Mm-hmm.
Marijuana not as much as alcohol, because marijuana is not as easily available as alcohol, but it's a preference thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about alcohol is that alcohol lets you sleep; it knocks you out. And if you're living on the street, then you know at the end of the evening, there's just like I have friends who are investment bankers who at the end of the evening need a drink.
Right.
So it's just like everyone else. But yeah, you're right. It does play a very significant role.
And they drink this stuff called Every Day, which sounds like it doesn't go down easy.
No. And yeah, I mean, that was Ashraf's favorite brand. But yeah, I was really fascinated by the names that all these alcohols had, because, you know, one's called Every Day, one is called Tufan, which means storm, one is called Gadar, which means, you know, mutiny or revolution. And I mean, I'd like to drink a drink that's called Revolution, you know. I drink that Kool-Aid.
Aman Sethi is with us. He's a correspondent for The Hindu, which is one of the largest English language newspapers in India. His new book is called A Free Man, A True Story of Life and Death in Delhi. If you'd like to be part of the conversation or ask a question, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Aman Sethi. He's a correspondent for The Hindu and author of the new book, A Free Man, A True Story of Life and Death in Delhi. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Aman, you go into this project, you have just begun work as a journalist, you have an idea about how to tell a story, how to gather the facts in a linear fashion, and it turns out that Ashraf was not someone who chose to tell his life story in a linear fashion. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of tension between the two of you as you tried to understand each detail, and he told you things as they occurred to him, as he felt you needed to know them, that sort of thing?
Right, so one of the things I realized when researching a biography, which is what it became, and of course, when I went in, I had no idea what I was really doing, because, you know, I had just started work. I figured it was fairly easy. You ask people questions, they answer the questions, you write down the answers, and you know, there you go. You know, you have a story. But what I was surprised to find was that this memo hadn't been circulated, and so there would be places where Ashraf would just be, you know, like, I am not answering this question, or I am not answering this question now, or I am answering this question in so tangential a fashion that I am just not answering this question. And so I sort of kept prying around the edges, and I think one of the things I realized over a period of time was that very often there are things that, to answer a question, you have to have the answer in your head. And there are many things in our lives where we haven't actually thought them through, but have rather kind of, you know, put a flag or a sort of marked them as unread and stored them in this, you know, in this archive of questions to be resolved at some particular time. And in Ashraf's case, because he'd clearly been through several fairly personally harrowing experiences, I initially had no sense of the sensitivities involved. So I think at some level I had the sort of presumption that journalists sometimes seem to have, which is that if I ask a question, you have to answer it, and this question can be as personal as I want, because I get to set the rules of this game. And I think Ashraf had a completely understandable pushback to that. And over a period of time, as someone was commenting, it's almost like the biography of someone who really doesn't want his biography written, because there are essentially ideas and themes that Ashraf has not thought through at the time that I ask him these questions, and probably does not have any intention of thinking them through, because we all need to keep ourselves in enough of ignorance to sort of get through the day, and to be confronted by someone who's constantly trying to remove that veil can be very disconcerting.
So Ashraf was in his early 40s when you first started interviewing him. And, you know, for someone who's able, fortunate enough to live a middle-class existence, that's when you're sort of just hitting midlife. It's really different if you're living and working on the streets and sort of tearing your body apart day after day, working so hard. And he was keenly aware of the encroachment of his own age.
Yes. In some senses, that is how... the book actually begins and introduces you to Ashraf, because time kind of takes its toll very differently on all of us, depending on what we do. And as a sort of tangent or a corollary, around the time of the London Olympics, I was listening to these interviews of these young, extremely fit athletes in their early 20s talking about, you know, I have only 2 more years, or I have only 3 more years, or I have only 4 more years. And you know, this most of us would feel absolutely privileged to be in that kind of shape at that age.
Mm-hmm.
But you realize that, and that's one thing that a Freeman sort of introduced me to, this idea of the body and physicality, which I hadn't really thought about how you need a kind of body to do a certain kind of work, and how your body is... Without the strength of your arms, or, you know, the stability of your legs or the flexibility of your spine, you're absolutely nobody. And particularly if you're working on the streets, and if you're sort of injured or you're ill, then it's a really kind of sharp and rapid descent.
One thing that people might not understand from listening to our interview is that much of the book, despite its very serious subject and its very sensitive treatment of everything in the book, is laugh-out-loud funny. And I wonder if you struggled at all with the tone of this, or based on the nature of your relationship with Ashraf, if that felt like the only way you could really tell his story.
Yeah, it wasn't a... I was quite clear that a Freeman would, like I said earlier in the interview, that I realized that workers are almost always sort of described solely through the prism of their work, and I wanted to take a step back and try and capture the sort of, you know, the kind of granular texture of life on the street, and life on the street is absolutely unlivable unless you have a healthy dose of really dark and a really macabre sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the jokes are always very pointed, they're directed at various people, they're extremely harsh and extremely personal, and so I wanted to somehow capture that sort of, you know, slightly toxic edged effervescence about the place. So the tone essentially came from just listening to the interviews again and again on my headphones and realizing, you know, this is really funny, and it's really sad that it's funny, and it's really funny that it's sad, and it just kind of goes on.
We have an email here from John who wants to know if Ashraf has read the book.
So while I was, Ashraf, of course, as I pointed out early in the book itself, Ashraf reads, or rather has a look at the article, and we're always in conversation about, you know, what's going on, what I'm looking at, what I'm thinking about. And a few months before the book actually went to print and we were finalizing the proofs, by then I was no longer in Delhi and Ashraf was in Calcutta. I was in Central India reporting this insurgency. And so I tried several times to call Calcutta and try and find Ashraf, and I couldn't find Ashraf. And the book came out, and then I said, you know, I have to find Ashraf. So I took time off from work, and I went to Calcutta to find Ashraf. And I arrived in Calcutta, and it took me a few days. And then I learned much to my sorrow and profound grief that Ashraf actually died of multi-drug resistant tuberculosis.
Oh, that's disappointing to hear, because in the book we know that he's been hospitalized, but we don't. That's very sad to learn that. I mean, that must have been a blow to you.
That was a body blow, because I wasn't expecting this at all. I knew that he had been ill, but as the book mentions that, you know, he, by the time I spoke to him, he had left the hospital. He said he was feeling better, that his treatment was almost over. He had taken a loan from a friend of mine. And, you know, he had promised me that, you know, he'd sort of, you know, set himself up and give me a call and give me his new coordinates. And because the thing was that Ashraf never had a phone, obviously. So it was, I could never contact Ashraf, and he was the only one who could contact me. And then when I learned of his death, it really, really kind of gutted me in that sense, because I was hoping that this book in some ways would be something that Ashraf and I could sort of sit and look at together.
Are there mechanisms in India for people who die indigent to have sort of a decent burial, that sort of thing, the disposal of the body?
Yeah, in Ashraf's case, his friend in Calcutta, there's a character called, a man called Raja, who is also introduced in the book. So he ensured that Ashraf was buried in a actually very, very lovely cemetery in Calcutta. So though he is in an unmarked grave, there are lots of unmarked graves, and so I went to the graveyard and spent some time by the grave. In India, I think there are lots of there are charitable organizations that do this sometimes, but I don't think there is a firm kind of government structure in place, but I think people who are Hindus tend to be cremated in an electric crematorium.
Mm-hmm. Talk about this. The book, it was interesting to reach the end and then find a sort of explanation of some of the terms in Hindi, which I do not speak. And there were a few times where I thought, oh, well, that was a dirty joke that I was reading in chapter 3 without realizing it. Talk about your choice to explain those things at the end of the book for what in this country will be largely an English-only speaking audience, as opposed to putting those up front.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that, of course, the language question was a big question even in India, because Hindi is one of 20-odd national languages that we have. And English is actually the kind of, you know, the way that a lot of India talks to each other. And a lot of my friends from South India, for example, also had no idea what these words meant.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a question of whether these words should be explained, whether they should be translated. I was quite clear that I wanted the book to reflect the language of the street, because it gave the narrative a sort of immediacy, and the big thing I noticed was that it's very, very hard to translate a multitude of characters, right? Because otherwise they all end up sounding just the same, because you're translating everyone. You are the sole translator for, you know, these five different characters, and next thing you know, Ashraf is speaking exactly like Lalu, who's speaking exactly like Rehan. But if you listen to the Hindi recordings, then each has a kind of really rich and distinctive way of speaking.
Hmm.
So when the book came out in India, the idea was that, you know, if you don't know the slang, then by reading the context, you'll sort of pick up the slang as you read on. When it came to releasing the book launching the book in America, I sort of had this sense that in some ways when for instance we read European literature, which kind of has, very often has significant amounts of French kind of embedded in the text, without any translation, but you kind of, you know, work around it and you figure it out. I just felt that if I could do it right, over a period of time, the reader would just start picking up the language on his own or her own. And a bit like, you know, Anthony Burgess's Clockwork Orange, right, where the first few chapters you're in this world where you're not entirely sure what's going on, but towards the end you actually feel like, hey, I get it, you know, I can tell the difference between a mazdoor and a beldar and a palledar and a chaiwala, and I just thought that the American audience would sort of appreciate that.
Yeah, I think it adds a sort of richness to it, especially, I think, as an American reader, recognizing that certain elements of this culture, no matter how much I read about them, will remain foreign to me unless I were to spend years living in this place. And so it's almost, to me, it felt almost like being a traveler, where you go somewhere and you essentially know what's going on, but occasionally there are things that baffle you. And I didn't find that a problem at all. It actually enhanced the reading for me.
Yeah, and the glossary, and which is why, again, with the glossary, instead of doing a sort of word-meaning format, I decided to do it again in yet more prose that, again, gave you a sense of how the word is used, right? Because if we just translate bhai as brother, then, and yaar as friend, then the kind of, you know, the subtle hierarchies and the subtle distinctions that make a place come alive are lost.
Talk about your interest now moving forward. I mean, obviously, you are still writing for The Hindu and you're doing short-form journalism, but do you want to continue? Do you think long-form journalism will remain part of your focus as you move forward?
Yeah, it's the thing is that it's a lot of work, you know. It's just, it's and it, you know, you figure that if you're doing more nonfiction and you're doing nonfiction, like book-length nonfiction, then you're looking at maybe a book every 3.5-4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think A Free Man sort of came out, you know, I was young, I met this man, and then I did interviews, and then the interviews became a book, and it sort of followed this kind of, you know, this momentum of its own. So before I knew it, I barely realized that, by the time I realized I was writing a book, it was too late. But now I think it seems sort of intimidating, to be honest. It seems far more intimidating than it did when I was doing this.
That's funny. Now that you know what's involved, it's a scarier prospect.
Yeah. It's the kind of, yeah.
Aman Sethi is a correspondent for The Hindu. His new book is called A Free Man, A True Story of Life and Death in Delhi. Aman, thank you so much for joining us, and take care of that cold, all right?
Yes, I will. Sorry about that. Thank you.
That's all right. Take care. Yeah. Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is sponsored in part by the Horchow family, celebrating the vast array of ideas heard each day on KERA.